It's Financial Freedom Friday, and on this episode of the Passive Real Estate Investing with Mavericks podcast, we are going to reveal who is lending for commercial properties.
Hey Mavericks, this is Ava Baukamp, and this episode of Passive Real Estate Investing with Mavericks is brought to you by Legacy Impact Investors. We are an industrial investment firm located in cash flow country, the Midwest. We strive to shield off risk and beat inflation, all while producing predictable cash flow. We curate real estate investment opportunities for busy professionals and other real estate investors seeking passive income. To learn more about what we do and connect with me, go to www.legacyimpactinvestors.com.
Maverick, noun, unusual person, a visionary, leader, go-getter, an independent thinker. They see the vision for their life and pull that future towards them with an unyielding belief that things can and must be better. They achieve what most won't. Innovative, influential, daring, and direct, with a remarkably high tolerance for taking calculated risk. A foe to the status quo. This is Passive Real Estate Investing with Mavericks. Your host, Neil Timmons, has been involved with over $300 million in real estate transactions. He's a published author, commercial property investor, and real estate syndicator. This show is for those who want to learn how to earn passive income through real estate investing. Now, here's your host, Neil Timmons.
Welcome to the Passive Real Estate Investing with Mavericks podcast, where we provide you with actionable steps to grow your passive income and become job optional. It's Financial Freedom Friday, and I'm here with Neil Timmons. During this episode, you are going to learn who lends on commercial properties. For those of you who are new, I'm your host, Ava Baukamp, and I love to educate investors about passive income from real estate. Before I open up today's episode, I want to ask you for a small favor. If you like what you're hearing, please give us a thumbs up and subscribe to the show so that you never miss a valuable episode. And if you love what you're hearing, please give us a written review. Also, be sure to take a look at the description of this episode as we have it packed with thousands of dollars in free resources. All right, Neil, it's another Financial Freedom Friday. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. This is going to be a fun one. I love talking about lending, and every day it feels like there's a new headline. And so for what's happening in interest rates and all those rates and everything Jerome Powell says and does deeply impacts the environment of lending.
Yeah, that's right. And this is the second episode in a series of three podcasts that we are doing about lending. We wanted to give everyone some data, some hard facts. And this podcast specifically will have lots of numbers for you. So if you missed the first one, go and check that one out. That will set up some context for this episode. But I want to open it up actually with why we're even talking about this. So we wanted to give you as a passive investor, as a listener of this podcast, some information, context around all of the headlines that you're probably seeing about commercial real estate and distress in the commercial real estate market and mortgages coming due, because we see a lot of scary headlines and it's best to arm you with some clarity and knowledge so you can ask the right questions, evaluate your options, and also be on the lookout for potential opportunities that we believe will be coming down the line with all of the distress that we're seeing in the commercial mortgage market. So today's podcast is all about who lends on commercial properties and how does this change based on different property types. So the total commercial real estate debt outstanding, this data is from TREP. They're one of the leading data providers on commercial real estate. The total outstanding chunk of commercial real estate debt as of Q2 2023 total is $5.8 trillion. And they compile this data based on Fed Reserve flows. So that's the total amount of outstanding debt, $5.8 trillion. But then over the next 5 years, almost 50% of that total amount is coming due. Those loans are maturing. So 2023 up until 2026, average is just over $500 billion in loans coming due. In 2027, we tick up above $600 billion in loans coming due. So Neil, can you just speak a little bit about what that actually means and the huge amount of money that's going to mature from a commercial debt standpoint over the next 5 years?
You bet. We touched on it in a deep fashion last week. I'll just bullet point. What does coming due mean? It means that the debt is coming 100% due and payable. So unlike a house loan that somebody ends up with a 30-year fixed rate and you pay it off over 30 years and that's it, these end up on typically 5-year fixed rates. And at the end of 5 years, your debt is due. And the significance of this is you may have borrowed at 3% or 4%. I say you. These mortgages may be at 3 or 4%. And today you're looking at 7 to 8%, depending on what it is. And a number of these people are going to have some challenges. And there's a tremendous amount of these mortgages that are coming due.
Yeah. So in total, over the next 5 years, we have about $2.28 trillion in loans that will totally mature. And of those maturing loans, TREP reports that banks and thrifts, thrifts meaning Saving and Loan Association, mutual savings banks, and credit unions, banks and thrifts actually hold half of the total amount of loans that are maturing. And so I broke down, they had a nice report on who actually owns, holds all of that commercial real estate. The top four holders of commercial real estate debt hold 92% of the total pie. So just over half are held by banks and thrifts. Then the next up, 16.82% of commercial real estate debt is held by GSEs, government-sponsored entities. These are Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Federal Home Loan Banks. Then up next with 13.53% are securitized, so commercial mortgage-backed securities and REITs. And then just under 12% are held by insurance companies. So those are the top four holders of commercial real estate debt: banks, GSEs, securitized, and insurance companies. So Neil, why don't you kick it off? We're going to run over six types of commercial lenders. This is not an exhaustive list, but just kick it off with traditional banks that hold commercial real estate debt.
Yeah, no, that's great. You just hit the top four, which own 92% of all the debt that's out there. And the biggest category are traditional banks, right? If they think of Wells Fargo, Bank of America, yes, but also just think of your bank down the street. We may not be a national bank. They're traditional banks, community banks. Their bread and butter happens to be commercial real estate as a whole, happens to be commercial real estate. This is how they make their money in a bank. A tremendous amount of their income is derived from this. And so they own a lot of the debt that's out there. They produce a lot of these things that get done. And as we get down to a couple of these other things, what you'll find is that the loans get bigger and bigger depending on who's doing the loan. But traditional banks fill a majority of the gap. And then you've got credit unions, right? The bank's redheaded stepchild. If you're a banker, not if you're a credit union, that's a different story. But the beef, of course, between banks and credit unions is credit unions don't pay taxes. And so it just looks very different between the two. So there's always been a beef, a longstanding beef between banks and credit unions. But credit unions fill that void as well. They're very active in terms of loans, some more than others, right? So think of like Navy Federal, and I can think of a handful in my state, probably four or five that are very large, that are very active in this. Now, I can also think of four or five credit unions in my city who are not very large. They're very small and they serve a very small niche, a boutique almost credit union for who they serve. So there's a wide variance in credit unions and what they do.
From, I think it'd be interesting if you gave the listeners just a little insight from the perspective of a bank versus a credit union. For someone who's not familiar with the fundamental structure difference, what is the difference between a bank and a credit union?
Yeah, I mean, the business model as a whole, credit unions have members. And so they're typically designed with some sort of membership that centers around a membership. And it could be, if you worked for a post office, you can be a member of a particular credit union. You know, Navy Federal, now that we're in the middle of football season, I see their commercials all the time. Gronk's on their commercials, and you have to be part of the military, right? A military family, or your family is your parents. And so they have a very unique niche in terms of who they serve. Banks, on the other side of this, is they're not membership based, right? They're for-profit based, and they're driving typically with their products in terms of getting people to do loans, whether it be a house or whatever it may be.
Awesome. So we've got banks, credit unions, then we also have non-bank lenders. They lend for commercial properties. And a lot of these are, we often think of large names. So Blackstone Mortgage Trust, Their ticker symbol on the stock exchange is BXMT, Starwood Property Trust. Then you also have private equity firms also lend for commercial real estate, Blackstone Group, Apollo Global Management. So those two kind of fill a similar type of void there in the commercial lending space. Then we also have GSEs. We touched on this at the beginning, government-sponsored enterprises, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. Neil, correct me if I'm wrong, these largely lend on multifamily.
Multifamily, you got it. Multifamily, and so what you'll find with these GSEs, Fannie Freddie, is that the loans are much bigger on average in comparison to ones that a bank would do.
Yep, and they usually have more attractive interest rates and longer terms.
No doubt, backed by the government, so you're exactly right about that.
And then last up, you actually have insurance companies lend on commercial real estate. So MetLife, Prudential, some of those larger insurance companies will lend on commercial real estate as well. And Neil, they usually have a more conservative approach.
More conservative in terms of a couple of ways. They require more money down. Therefore, the property and the cash flow must be very strong. They like stabilized properties, and that's their bread and butter. So they like big deals. To think $20, $25 million plus from a loan standpoint, and they require more money down, and they typically will fix an interest rate for a longer period of time. An insurance company, unlike a bank, has a different cost of funds. An insurance company is to fund their liabilities, which are insurance policies, and so they're planning a decade plus out. And so oftentimes you'll end up with a much longer fixed rate there than what you can at a bank, because a bank has a much shorter time frame in terms of how they're planning offsetting their liabilities, which are typically deposits.
Yeah, which has pluses and minuses depending on what you're going for.
Exactly.
All right. We wanted to talk a little bit about how the different property types influence loans that you can have access to, how lenders view those loans based on the different property types that they're lending for. So first up, multifamily, generally considered lower risk, and for those government-sponsored entities like Fannie and Freddie, you can get some of the best lending terms out there because the government is involved. Office, right now, you've probably seen a lot of headlines about office. It's in hot water at the moment due to high vacancies, COVID, remote work. Retail lenders, they place a high scrutiny on the location and the tenant mix because consumer demand can impact what's going on there. And then last up, we have industrial. This is our favorite. It's also considered relatively lower risk due to stable demand for warehouse and logistics. And sometimes you can secure pretty favorable terms on the industrial side as well. Neil, do you have any comments on property type and how that influences lending?
It really varies based on the property type and location, and then, of course, the tenants. There's no doubt about that. Think of a couple other things. Self-storage, mobile home parks come to mind, which has been a lot more challenging to secure financing in mobile home parks. You'll find that there are a number of lenders, specifically banks, who will not do mobile home parks due to the unique nature of what it is. And so you'll find some more specialized lenders in that area versus, say, for industrial or say multifamily, you'll often find lenders, lots and lots of lenders and banks lining up. They want to be actively participate and be in those businesses.
Mm-hmm. And I think the key thing to keep in mind here is, as a passive investor, what's the lender looking to do? They are looking to mitigate their risk. And so they're always assessing the property, the loan that they're considering based on how they can downplay as much as possible their risk. So they'll analyze a number of factors, and that will depend on the property type. But generally, they'll look at the location. Is it a solid location? Is it appropriate for the type of property that it is? Market conditions, population, employment, income, all of those things. The property's income generating potential. Remember, this is a key distinguishing difference between commercial real estate and residential real estate. The tenant's strength, especially if it's a single tenant property, they're going to place a heavy analysis on what's the credit worthiness of the tenant. Will they essentially be able to pay on a regular basis? Then they'll also evaluate the borrower's credit worthiness. So if something goes wrong with the tenant, with the property, is the borrower, are they secure enough to handle that cost and the borrower's experience? Neil, do you have any comments on risk and how a lender perceives risk as they're reviewing different loans?
Are you a passive real estate investor seeking financial freedom? Well, today's market's unique and it's ever changing. Now is the time to get educated on how to strategically invest in commercial real estate for long-term financial freedom. Grab your copy of How to Passively Invest in a Changing Economic Environment. Go to www.mavericksinvest.com. Yeah, as you go upstream in terms of the property quality and dollars and cents, some of the things that you just rattled off get tacked off the list. So when you end up in a, say, a $20 million property, doesn't call it industrial property for the sake of this example, and you're going to go, your lender will be an insurance company. The borrower's creditworthiness is not applicable. Now, they got to make sure you've never filed bankruptcy. There's a couple of things, but they're not digging deep like a bank would on a $2 million thing where there's a personal guarantee required. They're going to dig much deeper and require all sorts of tax returns from that individual. But when the property can stand on its own because of the way they underwrite that and because of the fact that they require more money down, some of those things just go away. Now, you mentioned borrower experience. When it comes to multifamily on a government-sponsored loan, the borrower experience is a huge deal. They want to understand at a very deep level what your experience is in order to be able to lend. The government-sponsored entity is they heavily scrutinize your experience when it comes to that.
I think there's two indicators as a passive investor can stick out to you that are an easy snapshot of how risky a lender might perceive a property to be. That doesn't mean it needs to be your indication of how risky it is and how willing you would be to evaluate that opportunity, but it's a quick snapshot, at least, of how risky a lender perceives the property and perhaps the general partner who's requesting the loan is LTV, loan to value, and DSCR, debt service coverage ratio. So generally speaking, lower loan to value and a higher debt service coverage ratio equals more perceived risk. Whereas if you have a higher LTV, i.e. the lender is willing to take a smaller down payment, and a lower debt service coverage ratio, you have less risk. So those are two quick snapshots there. What were you going to say?
I want to expand upon that because I know what you mean when you say higher debt coverage ratio equals more risk. When you say higher, what you're meaning is that relative to how much debt's there. So for example, if there's a $100,000 in debt due every year and you're at $110,000 in net income, so the ratio is 1.1, what you mean is higher, is that equals more risk. And when it's lower, I'll give you another example, say $100,000 still due and there happens to be $200,000 in income coming in. So your ratio is 2 to 1, right? Your debt coverage ratio is 2. It's much lower. It's less risk associated with that. And so you're spot on in terms of how that lender is going to view that.
Good clarification. So those are two quick snapshots as an investor, but it's good to understand how the relationship functions between those two different metrics. So I want to wrap up this episode with the key here is that lenders are concerned with mitigating their risk. They're going to be looking at the property and if things go south, how it will perform in a variety of circumstances, such as economic downturns, interest rate fluctuations, property value depreciation. They'll run a series of shocks and tests, hopefully to play out potential scenarios. How does this all impact you as an investor? For you, it's important that you understand the lender's role in placing the debt, how they evaluate deals, and this will make you a more sophisticated, savvy investor. It can help you understand potential risks and returns, and what you need here is clarity. As you're evaluating different opportunities, specific deals, you should be able to ask questions of the general partner or the sponsor that is presenting this deal, and they should be able to provide you with very clear answers about the lender, the terms, what they've done from an operational standpoint to mitigate risks. Have they run out for themselves potential scenarios? If there's increased vacancy or there's some other scenario, will they still be able to pay that debt? And it's important for you to know as a passive investor the certain types of deals and properties will have different lending terms and how that essentially, at the end of the day, impacts your returns as an investor. If you're asking questions of a general partner or a sponsor and you're getting vague answers or they're not able to articulate those answers clearly, that should be a red flag for you. So that's why it's important for you as a passive investor to understand this lending landscape. Neil, can you wrap up this episode from the perspective of a general partner? We make deals available to investors. What are a few things that passive investors might not necessarily understand from general partner side about what it takes and what's involved in placing debt on a property and why that's really critical to the health and the success of that particular investment?
Well, it's a good question, and it's an ever-changing landscape. When we've got, I'll give you an example that we're going through right now. We've got a deal we're working on that's active today. We're going off and now shopping lenders. So it requires us talking to somewhere between 5 and 10 different lenders, because what we'll find is 2 or 3 different lenders out of that list are just not going to have any interest because of their own bank situation, their credit union situation. They're not actively lending. And so you deal with the remaining folks to have conversations, to outline what it is that we're doing, what's the project, what's our history if it's a new relationship for us, and go through and understand their process. And every bank's a little different, or credit union is a little different in terms of how they do things. And a big one is understanding that when a rate locks, and so interest rates are tied, when I say interest rates, the 5 and the 10-year treasury are bouncing all over, and they constantly change. And so understanding when does that rate lock? So ideally, if we get something that we love today, want to move forward with the lender, I want that rate to lock now. Instead of, literally, we've had a handful. On the positive side, we'll lock for 30 to 60 to 70 days, somewhere in that kind of range. On the other side is 3 to 7 days prior to closing. So although we have an idea of what the rate would be today, it's not locked. And we're not going to know what the rate is until somewhere between 3 and 7 days prior to closing. And you're rolling the dice. And so for us, it's about risk mitigation. You've talked about that from a lender standpoint. We do the exact same thing from an investor standpoint when we put a deal together, is mitigating the risk all the way through the chain. And we just could never accept until every lender's out there doing a deal where you can't get a rate until 3 days prior to closing. You're better off knowing exactly what that is so you can plan. And then once you select a lender, from our standpoint, is providing them tremendous amounts of documentation. They're literally like, I don't know how to give, you're practically married to this person from that point until the day you close, because it is a lot of communication, a lot of interaction, checking a lot of boxes to be able to get that loan over the finish line.
Yeah. And I think that's, as a passive investor, if you're investing with the right general partner and the right operator, they are doing a lot of legwork for you, taking on a lot of communication, in providing details to multiple lenders to shop, find the best rate, the best terms. And I think it's easy to gloss over that when you're being presented with an opportunity to sometimes forget that there's a lot of time that is involved on the backside from the general partner side to even get to the spot where they have a loan that's ready to be paired with that particular investment. So that's a huge benefit of being a passive investor, is you don't have to do that. You don't have to speak with 12 different lenders. You don't have to figure out how to time the rate lock with closing and due diligence. There's a lot of nuance and time and thought that goes into that. And so that's a huge benefit of being a passive investor, is that lending side, that burden does not fall on you. All right, next week, we are going to wrap up this short series on lending, and we're going to be talking about paying off loans. What's the process? What are the potential snags and snares? And how does this impact you as a passive investor?
To our listeners, pat yourself on the back. You guys have made it to the end of the show, and most people never finish what they start. If you receive value from today's show, be sure to share it on LinkedIn, your Facebook page, or your social media platform of choice. Subscribe to never miss a valuable episode in the future. And if you found value in today's episode, give us a thumbs up with a positive review. If there's a particular topic you'd like to hear about, well, I want to hear from you. Shoot me a message on LinkedIn. The link to my profile is below in the show notes. You can connect with me there for more valuable content.